Hi, everybody. So nice to be with you. So glad to be here. And yeah, just feeling the joy already of this refuge of Sangha and seeing some familiar faces and new faces, new names, and just immense gratitude that we have this opportunity to come together in this way. It's really remarkable. Really special. And I taught for Sangha Live a couple years ago and I really enjoyed it. And last year, his schedule was a little full, so I didn't get a chance to be here. So it feels really good to be back. And we're going to start with a meditation in a moment. But I just want to say that another reason this feels like an auspicious time to be together is that this is the first teaching and being with Sangha since I've come back from the month-long silent retreat I sit every year. It's my 15th long retreat of a month or 3 months. And I've done that every year since 2011 now. So it's just wonderful to get to be together after that silence. And we'll see what happens. Yeah, we'll see what happens today. It's always an exploration, right, of what emerges from the questions you bring. And then the theme we're exploring today, I feel quite passionate about. So I'm looking forward to our talk as well. So just an invitation to get whatever you need to be comfortable and at ease. And actually, before I go into guiding the meditation, I just want to check to make sure that everyone can hear me. I recognize sometimes I can speak a little softly, especially after long retreat. You can hear me. Okay. That's important. So if you have any trouble hearing, maybe you can just send a note to Faith and she can get my attention about that. But glad to know that you can hear me well. All right, so just settling in, getting whatever you need for your body to. Raphael, thank you. Thanks for the feedback. Good to see you. Getting whatever you need for your body to really feel supported and at ease. So we want to be both alert and also relaxed for our practice, really taking care of yourself. And in a moment, I'll ring this bell, and I just want to invite you to follow the sound of the bell all the way to its vanishing point with your attention. Might be a shorter vanishing point on Zoom, but seeing if you can follow the sound. And so we gently turn our attention inward. One way to experience this is that we are entering the temple of our own inner life, which is a reflection of an expression of this greater mystery of aliveness, this experience of being a human being. And that we utilize this capacity of mindfulness. It's like a doorway into that mystery, a doorway into the inner temple. So if it's comfortable for you, inviting eyes to close if they're not already closed. And of course, for some that may not be supportive for your practice, you can just have a soft gaze downwards with the attention drawn inward. Generally, in our tradition, we close the eyes if that's okay for you. And then we bring mindfulness front and center. Mindfulness all around. And arriving we can often arrive in body. Now maybe we've opened our laptop or turned our phone on for the session and the body has come to stillness, but we haven't really arrived. So lining up with your intention. To arrive here in the room where you are. And also here in this collective space that we co-create together across time zones and locations. Arriving. So where do we arrive? We arrive here. And when do we arrive? Now. Just now. This particular moment. However it may be for you, we're not waiting for a better moment to arrive. Not waiting for conditions to be different. And this moment and all it contains is worthy of our full mindful attention. We arrive just as we are, with conditions exactly as they are in this moment. As we arrive, we become available. You become available to the moment, and the moment becomes available to us. And when we touch into this availability, the vastness of that, we can recognize the value in aligning with something larger than our reactive minds that want things, don't want other things, trying to control, manage, plan, review, get more, be more, do more, fix. Whatever the reactive mind, heart may be doing. And so we can recognize the value in aligning with a heart's deeper aspiration or intention that really calls us to practice. What it is we deeply value. So Dharma gives us a ground from which to meet life. It's actually onward leading. So it can be helpful at the beginning of practice just to reflect on your intention, what you're aligning with, and that you've arrived, you're present, available. What is the heart, mind, body aligning with? Maybe it's your intention to cultivate loving kindness for yourself or others, compassion. Or you may be aligning with the teaching around wise view, wise understanding. The Buddha taught, or the whole of the Eightfold Path. Whatever it is for you. Pausing to align with this deeper intention that brings you to practice. And from this space, having arrived, become available and present and aligned, we turn to the first foundation of mindfulness, this mindfulness of the body. Arriving in the body. Here and now. This body, just as it is. Not fixing the body, not changing, not comparing, judging. Not the mind's commentary, but the immediate, direct experience. The mystery of our aliveness. can make contact with the felt sense of all the touch points of the body. No feeling and sensing where the sits bones are contacting the chair, the cushion underneath you. And mindfulness is simply knowing the felt sense of the heaviness there, the pressure, or the firmness, whatever the sensations are that are happening here and now. And the felt sense of the feet contacting the ground or the mat underneath us. Just aware of the sensations there. And the touch of the hands. You might be aware of the sensations at the palms where the hands are resting on the lap, or the felt sense of the palms touching clothing, noticing warmth or coolness or tingling. Changing stream of sensation, the river of aliveness we call body. And of course, we may notice the attention wandering back into the endless mind stream, and you can actually just smile at the mind, not a problem. Mind is actually the sixth sense in Buddhism, so the mind thinks just like the ears hear, and the nose smells. Not a problem that we're not following the thinking. We're gently learning to attend to our direct experience here and now, and we're gathering, we're collecting the attention here and now into the present moment. The immediacy of our experience through the doorway of the sensations that we're aware of in the body. So we may notice a thought or being lost in a whole succession of thoughts, no problem. And we're also not staying there. We're not pushing it away, the thought, or pushing away the stream of thinking. But we're also not feeding it. We're just gently coming back to the felt sense of the seat, the feet, the touch of the hands. And then we may notice also the experience of this body breathing. Notice there's no you doing the breath. Breathing is happening. It's always happening now, we just rarely notice it. Our invitation to gently begin to keep the breath company with your kind attention, just lightly resting your mindful attention on the breath. Just wherever you're noticing it. So some of you, maybe it's going to be the belly, and you can feel the gentle rise and fall of the belly, the inhalation, the exhalation. And some of you, maybe it's the chest, or it's right below the nostrils. You notice warm or cool air passing in and out there. Or the felt sense of whole body breathing. For some of you, if the breath is not so supportive as an anchor, you may just stay with the touch points of the body or the felt sense of whole body sitting or in stillness and whatever posture you're in. Just practicing like that on your own for a while. Coming back if you notice you're wandering. This gentle attention to the anchor. Just a gentle awareness of what's happening now. Just noticing if the attention has gotten lost or drifting off or pushing something away or lost in a thought storm or whatever may be happening. Just allowing that to be your doorway back in. In that moment of noticing, mindfulness has returned. Softening into whatever is arising as part of the path. And this too, this moment of aversion or the sounds that we may be hearing in the background, or the ache in the body. Or the sense of contentment or calm that may be arising, whatever is here. This too I can include in my field of kind attention. And as we move towards closing our meditation today, just an invitation to pause and notice if there's any sense of refuge that you discovered in taking this time for practice. Even if it was a challenging session for you at times, or mind was agitated, or heart was stirred up, or discomfort, or maybe sense of ease, whatever was here, just pausing to see if you can connect with the refuge of this practice. This capacity to cultivate mindfulness, to put the teachings of the Dharma into practice. The refuge of the Sangha, the community that's here practicing with you. And the Buddha, whether that's your own Buddha nature, the historical figure of the Buddha, that none of us would be here without this being who discovered something about the reality of being human, about suffering and the end of suffering, and shared what he discovered out of compassion. Thousands of years later, here we are, the beneficiaries of his wisdom, thanks to the Sangha, and preserve the teachings and pass them on. And seeing if you can connect with the sense of being held in something larger than whatever may be arising, passing away in your own mind, heart, and body. And if there's any sense of gratitude for that, just an invitation to really take that in, to let the heart, mind, and body be nourished by that. Thank you, everybody, for your practice. It's a delight to sit with you. So I just want to talk about our topic for today, which is finding refuge amidst uncertainty. And just to name that for many of us, you know, the world feels like an unsafe place right now. And in many ways, of course, it has for a long time. It's just kind of the nature of it. And here in the U.S. where I live, there's a lot of political suffering, political divisiveness, systemic racism, the inequality, the challenges around socioeconomic inequality, climate change, it just goes on and on, decreasing resources. And there's our own personal suffering, which of course is linked with the suffering of our communities and of our world, not separate at all. This is the truth of interdependence. We have lots of strategies for trying to manage this. The suffering we see in ourselves or in our country or in our world. I just want to name that it's so natural that the heart-mind seeks refuge. Our bodies, our hearts, our minds long deeply for a place to rest and a sense of safety in a world that feels unsafe and uncertain. And so just to feel the tenderness of that human condition that we're experiencing in this particular moment in time, but that human beings have experienced for thousands of years, just part of the human condition. And just to say the word refuge, I like sometimes when I'm teaching to just go to the dictionary to find the definition of the word. And the definition of refuge is a condition of being safe or sheltered from pursuit, danger, or trouble. So I'll come back to this later. What is the danger or trouble that we're seeking refuge from, really? Come back to that. But just to name again this innate search that we have as human beings for refuge. We can often seek and sometimes find temporary or false refuge, we might call it, in other things. So maybe distraction, right? That's a really big one. Distraction, entertainment, and different ways we are numbing ourselves with technology or with food or taking in too much information all the time. Or we try to take refuge in views and opinions that we have. So we see the pain in the world and we think, you know, we know the way to fix it. It's this way because of that. And it's so much worse than things used to be, or actually it's getting better, or it's been this way before. It's never been this way, or it's this way for that reason or this reason. Totally understandable. The mind is kind of churning out these views and opinions. But the Buddha's invitation was not to take refuge in a set of views and opinions or beliefs to subscribe to that would fix the world's suffering once and for all. And actually, he really cautioned us against getting lost in views and opinions. It's not onward leading. It's not actually helpful when it comes to alleviating our suffering or the suffering of those around us. Of course, we have them. It's good to know, oh, that's a view and an opinion, right? May be true, may not be true. So it was a radical invitation the Buddha offered us to look deeply into the nature of our own minds and hearts, to turn towards our own experience, to grow our own capacity for wisdom and insight. It's actually our birthright as human beings. And to respond skillfully to the changing conditions of this world as it actually is, the fundamental uncertainty of it all from this place. This is why meditation, practice, being in Sangha, hearing the teachings is not a false refuge. It's a way of resourcing ourselves to move back out into the world with hearts and minds that might be just a little bit more sane than they were when we first sat down for practice. We need more sanity in this world, so it's quite a powerful thing to choose to practice in these times. So the tool the Buddha offers us is understanding understanding through our own direct experience here and now. And so there's a paradox in the refuge that we find in practice, because it is not the refuge of removing ourselves. And of course, we do need to do this at times. There's different ways we do this, just even small, simple ways. We come home, you know, at the end of a long day at work, and that's a refuge for us, right? That feeling of like, oh, okay, I'm back in a space where I can rest, right? Safe place. Or we go away in nature if we can at times to rest and restore ourselves. Or again, maybe retreat practice is a part of your life. Right? But these are temporary conditions. They're temporary refuges. They're outer refuges. This is from the Dhammapada. It says, they go to many a refuge, to mountains, forests, parks, trees, and shrines. People threatened with danger. That's not the secure refuge. That's not the highest refuge. That's not the refuge having gone to which you gain release from all suffering and stress. But when, having gone for refuge to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, you see with right discernment the four noble truths, stress, the cause of stress, the transcending of stress, and the Noble Eightfold Path, the way to the stilling of stress, that's the secure refuge. That, the highest refuge, that is the refuge having gone to which you gain release from all suffering and stress. So very counterintuitive, right? This secure refuge is the refuge of being with, not fighting reality, but opening to it, learning about this reality of being human, being willing to actually show up for life, to live out the moments of this life as they're actually unfolding on life's terms. And then we have this skillful frame of the Four Noble Truths that we're being pointed to in the Dhammapada to understand what's happening, to actually develop this wisdom and insight. This is from Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, not a teacher who's not in our insight meditation tradition, but there's actually quite a few interesting things to say, even though he wrote these things. I think probably this was in the 70s, but very relevant to our time now. He says, don't fight with reality. Don't defend against it. Rather, read it like you would a newspaper. Read everything that happens to you and to others as pertinent news about the reality of being human, of being you. So this is viewing our lives through the lens of the Dhamma that becomes a refuge for us. We're always going to see the three characteristics. If we stay present long enough with mindfulness, we begin to know the nature of how it is. It's lawful. This is Dharma. It's nature in that way. We see conditions are inherently unstable. They're impermanent. They're constantly changing. They're unsatisfactory. It's not a mistake. There's no permanent fixed me who this is all happening to here. It's not personal. These are just the conditions. Doesn't mean we can't skillfully participate in changing conditions. So like here in the U.S., there were lots of demonstrations yesterday. They're very joyful, actually, right? People protesting our current administration. But first, we have to turn towards what's here, right, to see it clearly. And then we find a way to respond with skillful actions and wisdom. So the more clearly we see this, that these are the conditions, the more our hearts begin to incline towards the wisdom, right, in going for refuge in something larger than our other strategies for finding solace, finding comfort, right? Controlling conditions, trying to accumulate more pleasant experiences to make permanent that which is impermanent, to get rid of the unease of the dukkha nature of life. Or constantly constructing a self, right? A me who this is all happening to, telling the story of me and keeping that together. So we begin to see the wisdom in being willing to mindfully bear the dukkha of the moment, to see clearly how often experience is changing, and that we can't find lasting refuge in pleasant moments or creating conditions to be the way that we would like them to be. As soon as there's a moment of conditions coming together in a way that this me thinks, oh, that works, what's going to happen? Right? They all fall apart again. It's constantly changing. It's not personal. It's not our personal failing, right? The small self, the ego's thinking that one day it's going to find a way to get everything just right, just in place. It's not like that. So it becomes a refuge to turn towards the truth of things, because we're actually aligned with how it is so that we can relate skillfully. So we can, of course, find temporary comfort at times, and we can self-soothe in ways that are helpful, and that can be skillful to do, of course, you know. But we're seeing, right, wisdom, discernment, equanimity begins to recognize that this is not a lasting place, that we can find true refuge when conditions are inherently unstable and they're uncertain and they're out of control. So we begin to see the wisdom in going for refuge in what are known as the three jewels, refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And I loved learning about why they're called the three jewels when I was preparing for this talk. And this was from Tanisaro Bhikkhu. He said they're called jewels or gems, both because they're valuable, but also because in ancient times, gems were believed to have protective powers. And so we often talk about going for refuge in these three as being a real protection, because it's an inner safety that gives rise to this kind of courage or fearlessness. Because again, we're not trying to run away from the human condition. We're not thinking it's going to be otherwise, and that gives us a kind of courage, right? And that we're taking refuge in something larger. So the Buddha, traditionally, you know, this is the historic Buddha, and it also can be Buddha nature. We'll talk about that a bit. And then the Dhamma, this is the timeless teachings of the Buddha, and also has the connotation Dhamma or Dharma. So Dhamma is the Pali translation, Dharma is the Sanskrit. And this also has the connotation of the truth of things. And Dhamma is like the truth of things as they are, or nature. Like it's gravity is that's nature. It's the truth of things as they are. You know, we can say, oh, I don't like gravity. I don't think it's a good idea, but gravity is going to be gravity, right? So this is the Dhamma. And so going for refuge in the three jewels, this becomes a relief, actually. It's truly a timeless refuge. These three don't change as a refuge, no matter how radically our outer conditions do. And experiencing these three as a refuge, this is something that grows stronger in us the more we see things clearly. The more we develop insight, the more this becomes natural, and our faith and trust in these three can grow. The more we turn towards them, the more we give ourselves over to them. And in this way, we join the stream of so many countless human beings over thousands of years who have found a way through the confusion of the human condition, the ignorance the Buddha spoke of, that is the root of our suffering. So just to come back to that original definition of refuge, I said, I'll come back to what is the danger or the trouble. It's here. The danger or the trouble is our own confusion. It's not personal that we're confused. It's kind of wired into the mind, right? And by confusion, I don't mean like, well, yeah, what's meant by confusion is the Buddha pointing to our fundamental confusion about the cause of our suffering and the cause of relief from that suffering, our true well-being, right? So the deluded, confused mind is run by aversion and grasping, clinging. But as we see more clearly, we begin to let go of some of those habits. So, you know, when the pandemic first happened, it was interesting. I noticed that the heart mind was going for refuge. It wasn't something I particularly intended to do. But when I reflected, that was really what was happening. You know, times were so uncertain. And again, they continue to be. So many have said we're living through, you know, a global polycrisis and environmentally, economically, so many different ways, this interconnected suffering. And one of the other experiences that I lived through recently was the wildfires that just happened here in Los Angeles, where I live. And some of you here, I think a few folks from Los Angeles are also here today. And, you know, they were among the most destructive in California's history. They were burning through, you know, vast areas. They were devastating surrounding communities. And of course, they continue to have an impact. And I've reflected often on refuge throughout this time because of being displaced from the fires. And of course, we're seeing many people being displaced right now, not just because of the fires, but because of what's happening here in the U.S. So to really reflect, you know, for me, it was 6 weeks of displacement. And I didn't know I was going to be gone for so long. So I brought all my Dharma journals. I brought my passport. I brought my meditation cushion. These were the essentials, you know, but I didn't really bring enough socks or and what I found was that, you know, my practice of going for refuge in practice itself that supported me, you know, refuge in Dharma. The heart mind was not taking personal the impersonal conditions. It doesn't mean it wasn't difficult, but there were impersonal conditions that led to the fires, right? Including climate change, of course. And so this was the reality, and I could see and feel the three characteristics in real time in the experience. Just noticing that. There was dukkha in it, of course. There was a lot of suffering and still is in relation to the land and the loss of many people's homes. But the heart mind could turn towards the dukkha nature of it and actually stay present. And that capacity was supported by going for refuge in the Dharma. And then one of the most significant refuges I experienced was not the four walls of the buildings that I would stay in. It wasn't having a place to sleep at night. It was actually human kindness, human goodness. The refuge was actually other human beings, their care, the kindness that they expressed, the messages that came in, and seeing the community in my neighborhood, you know, people taking care of each other, checking on each other, making sure they were okay. And when I reflected on it, it was like a previously invisible net of human kindness that became visible because of these unexpected, uncertain conditions. It was revealed, you know, the crisis revealed the caring nature of people's hearts, those in my life. And I was the beneficiary of their care, and it resourced me deeply during a time I thought I may lose my home because the fires, they burned up to the walls of my house. but I'm in it right now, still here. But when I look out at the land, you know, it's all these burned trees and, you know, right there in the backyard. So it's a reminder constantly, right, of the impermanent nature. But what lives inside me is the refuge of Sangha. And so it wasn't just the Dharma that was a refuge. You know, Sangha provides us this beautiful example of a community that's grounded in shared values that are wholesome. So Sangha shows us the full range of humanity. We contain all of it, the seeds of greed and aversion and delusion. And then we also have so many other seeds inside: love, compassion, wisdom, clarity, kindness. And so the Sangha, this is a community of people devoted to developing these qualities, expressing them. And because we're all wired to be in connection with others, we have this deep need to feel a sense of belonging. To be with Sangha is a true refuge. And so when we're feeling doubtful, or we're feeling lost, or we're feeling fearful, or we're uncertain, or we're afraid or struggling, it's so important that we turn towards community, towards Sangha, and others who are expressing this care. This can lift our hearts and minds, remind us of our own nature. And it's kind of like we take turns, you know? We take turns. So somebody's unsteady, and then maybe another person is resourced and they can show up and support you. Or maybe, you know, you come to a meditation and you really feel shaky, but you feel the larger whole, right, of the field of the Sangha supporting you, and you know you can do your practice. The Buddha talked about noble friends, right? So some of you may know the teaching, right? Venerable Ananda, who was the Buddha's cousin and attendant, came to him and he had this realization, oh, Sangha is so important. It's such a really important part of the path. And the Buddha said, oh, no, Ananda, don't say that. It's Sangha is all of the path. It's actually all of the path. It's a big statement. And so why would that be? Well, left to our own devices, this human mind heart, right? We go back into confusion, right? The practice, we often say it's going against the stream, what we're doing. So we see the stream out there. The stream out there in worldly life that we're all involved in, we all have to find a way to make our way in the world and survive, of course. But that stream is largely fueled by greed and aversion and delusion, with pretty unwholesome results. A lot of suffering from that. And so we need to be reminded of this other possibility, a different way to live. And so being with noble friends, right? Aya Kema, who's passed away, but wonderful Theravadan nun, excellent teacher. I recommend you listen to some of her talks if you're interested, or read her books. The first book on Buddhism I read was written by her, so I like to honor her sometimes in my teaching. And she talked about how being with noble friends, the thoughts in their mind are more onward leading, basically. Less self-concern, less just being caught in the reactive mind, right? Their minds and hearts are turned towards the Dharma and the path, right? Even if we get lost or confused, we bring each other back. So we have a way of being together, and also that noble friends are an antidote to the hindrances. She talks about that, the ways we get caught in obstacles in meditation. So we do need to stay in touch with Sangha. And that's one of the reasons I love being here with Sangha Live, right? The whole intention of this is to bring people together to support your practice. So, so important. So I just encourage you to turn to others for refuge, right? Those who embody Buddha nature, Sangha, who are expressing beautiful or wholesome qualities of heart and mind. And then again, this is part of why refuge in the Buddha is so valuable for us too. And it can be, again, the historic figure of the Buddha, very inspiring sometimes to read about his life, his practice, his teaching. And then we can all connect with the Buddha nature in us, part of what the Sangha seeks to express. So there are beings who express Buddha nature. And I really felt this when I lived with my good friend's 92-year-old grandmother for a week unexpectedly during the evacuation. And it was the first week when the fires were happening, and, you know, checking in every day, I hear about a neighbor two houses down, their house burned down. And, you know, I thought any moment my house may burn down, it may be gone. And, you know, I had the great privilege and blessing of living with this woman who I'd never met. Her name is Helene Trock. Does not identify as a Buddhist, to be clear, but she was very much like a Buddha in the way that she lived. She just embodied so much equanimity, so much kindness, and her steady presence and her care just was such a resource, right? She'd never met me before, but she generously opened her home to me. You know, this is, the Buddha talks about generosity. And we reflected on our lives together. I heard her stories, you know, about being a young woman growing up in New York and just everything she'd learned in her life. And this was a way where the mind would get organized, of course, around the fear, the uncertainty about what was happening with the fires. Then I would turn towards her caring presence. And that was there too. That was there too. It really impacted me during a time I was so vulnerable. And she said something so beautiful. She said, "You have to leave room in your life for the unexpected to happen." She said, "I never expected to meet you, but it was such an unexpected gift to be together that came out of conditions that on first glance you would say, oh, that's really terrible." And of course, it is terrible in many ways. And, you know, my experience was of such immense kindness. And so the heart can find refuge in that to hold the difficulty. Right? They're there together. And so we can reflect on the lives of some great beings who embodied Buddha nature, regardless of, you know, whatever spiritual tradition they were part of or not. Right? The heart mind that's awake to its true nature, it wants to be generous, to help, to not cause harm, to alleviate suffering. It's innate in us, and we have to look for it. So I reflect on this often, because again, we can get organized around noticing the opposite of this. The non-Buddha nature is very painful to see. And we don't want to turn away from, right? So we're not putting on rose-colored glasses. This is a practice of turning towards, right? Clearly, clear seeing. But what supports us in that clear seeing is remembering, right? Remembering what's possible. And so we can turn towards this. And I think often of some of my Dharma sisters, you know, practitioners and other teachers who've sat long retreats with me, who teach and serve the Sangha, and they uplift my heart, you know. Or great teachers, who taught my teachers, Deepa Ma, Ajahn Chah, and some other teachers I mentioned, Ayakema. So there's much more I want to say to you about all this, but I also would like to hear your questions. So I think I'm going to just share one more thing about Buddha nature and a reflection for you. And then I'd like to open it to hear from you so there's time. So I just want to say that you know, the practice of metta, when we practice metta quite deeply, that can support us in seeing the Buddha nature in others. And so it's said in the suttas, you know, the Buddha said, "The liberation of mind through loving kindness has beauty as the highest perception." This is because no one appears repulsive to someone who abides in loving kindness. And I mentioned Deepa Ma, that teacher. You know, somebody asked her once, you know, what was in her mind? And she paused and she said, concentration, loving kindness, and peace. So just to imagine the mind that's just filled with concentration, loving kindness, and peace, how it experiences another human being. Capacity to see Buddha nature in others. So maybe something you're interested in practicing with. So just encourage you to reflect on these three ways you might bring them into your life more. And also any false refuges. At the beginning of the talk, I spoke a little bit about false refuge, ways that we move towards attempting to feel safe or comfort ourselves that maybe are not so helpful. Sensing into your own relationship with these three. What are some ways you may go for refuge if you're drawn to this practice? Remembering the possibility of a different way of meeting life. Staying close into these three, helping us nurture the seeds that support our peace and participating in nurturing peace in the world. So I think I'll close there the talk, and I want to thank you for your kind attention. I see a hand up and would love to hear from you. I'm aware that it was a request for me to just say about Donna again for a moment. I think it was already mentioned, but just to say that the majority of my income and livelihood is the generosity of others. So I really appreciate any support you offer. And also it's such a joy to share in that with Sangha Live and with other organizations that support these teachings and support making them freely available to others. And it's a very different way of participating in the world. It's not the fee-for-service model. It's really shared from the heart. And then your support, it's very meaningful because it supports me in being able to pass on the teachings to others and to go on retreat and study with my teachers and give them Dana. And so it's really like this beautiful, wholesome cycle. So I think that's all I'll add to what was shared about Donna. And I hope that's helpful, Faith. I know you asked me to talk about that. So we appreciate deeply anything you offer. Thank you for that. And I think it was Bartek. Please let me know if I say your name incorrectly. Got to get you unmuted.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Hi.
Oh, hi. Yeah, hi. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Did you just came out of the 1 month retreat, did you say? Yeah.
I did, yes.
Well, that's amazing. I'm impressed that you said that's 15 years now you've been doing this long retreat every year.
Yes. Yeah, wow, sometimes long retreats a year. Yeah.
And yeah, that's amazing. And what's changed the last, you know, and over this time? And, you know, for you, because you can look back now and definitely something, you know, you different approach, yeah, and views, and maybe you can let go of something. And yeah, can you tell me, you know, those months retreat, would you advise them or other people also to do, or daily practice is enough, sufficient, stable every day? in your opinion, maybe?
Yeah, thanks for your question. I think that what I would say is it's a longer retreat can be very supportive and helpful if you're drawn to it and the conditions in your life allow that to happen. But if you feel drawn and you have experience and you've sat, you know, other, 10-day or week-long, several, you know, enough to feel steady in your practice, you're drawn to it, then yes, I would say it's a wonderful thing to prioritize if it's available to you. For me, after my first retreat, it was only a week, I wanted to stay and continue practicing. You know, some people are like, I can't wait to get home, which is also understandable. I've had those kind of retreats too, don't get me wrong. But I really wanted to stay. And my teacher said, well, maybe you want to sit a month long. I was very glad that they encouraged me, because the next year I came and I met someone who'd been sitting a month long every year for 10 years, and he kind of inspired me. He was a wonderful therapist. And so that was how that happened. But I just want to say that daily life practice is so powerful. You know, it's so important. And short retreats are so important. I have also taught weekend retreats and sat weekend retreats where it's 3 nights, and it's the effort and the being available, like we did in the meditation, that people bring, because they know these are the 3 nights I have, and they show up wholeheartedly. So, and this is again just my view, views and opinions,
that's
right?
Okay.
From my view, somebody can go to a month long and kind of drift on a whole month of practice, knowing they have a month, and somebody can come for 3 days and really show up. And so it's not, you know, might work that way. Like if you have a month, then you're going to go deeper or something like that. It's really about so many causes and conditions that come together. But if you're drawn to it, it's very powerful to sit for longer periods. It's quite different than just sitting a short retreat. Definitely.
That's true. Thank you. I have another question, just so quickly. I don't want to drag it too much here. I'm sure other people waiting. Also, I agree with refuge in the Sangha and Buddha, for obvious reasons, you know, where I'm quite... I'm aware. But, you know, with the Dhamma or Dharma, it's harder to develop this refuge because everything changes so quickly, right? And things not always go so, you know, easy for us. So that's unexpected, you know, and it's hard to develop this refuge and trust. So how to deepen this trust in the Dhamma, you know, to this refuge in the Dhamma as well? And can you, give us some maybe... your reflections, or maybe how you're taking refuge in the Dhamma, and how it works for you. Please, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for your question. Really good question. And that's what I was pointing to in my talk, that there's a paradox, right? There's a paradox in going for refuge in the Dhamma, because something in our mind, heart, reflexively wants to move away from seeing that things are inherently unsatisfactory, impermanent, that there's no fixed self here. Those are all the things that the mind heart tries to organize around and construct to feel safe. So it's counterintuitive. But the more we practice, we begin to feel, it's like all of us can feel, everybody here can feel the refuge of mindfulness. Right. Even when what you're mindful of is really unpleasant. You know, it's quite different to be experiencing something unpleasant with no mindfulness. Then you're just suffering, but it's the suffering consciously that changes our relationship to that, that leads us into freedom from conditions. That's what the Buddha taught, is it's not a happiness that is condition-based. And so the more that we nurture our capacity to meet those conditions through a Dharma lens, paradoxically, it establishes a deeper ground of well-being, because we're not finding our well-being in the outer conditions that are uncertain and constantly changing. So that was what I was trying to point to and give a dramatic example like the fires here, because it was a dramatic example of recognition for me that there was refuge in this practice, that the training showed up under conditions that were extremely uncertain. You know, my home could have been gone. And again, you know, I don't claim to know the experience of those who lost their homes, and I feel immense compassion. You know, I don't know what that, how I would have been, you know, had that happened, but it was difficult, right? And the practice of seeing impermanence and the mind being lined up to that is the way it is, right? It eliminates a lot of our extra suffering, the selfing around it and making it personal, collapsing under it and trying to control conditions.
So seeing Dhamma with understanding, you would say, that's what's refuge for you, right?
Learning to turn towards the Dhamma instead of the story about it and see it through the lens of the three characteristics. You know, you can practice that like in your daily life.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah.
Trying. Thank you very much. Thanks. That was helpful.
I'm glad. Thanks for it.
Yeah, nice to meet you.
So other questions? I think we have a few minutes if there are other questions, or it could also be just a reflection on your practice or something that was shared in the talk or the meditation. Yeah, Jessica, hi.
Hi. I was listening to what you were saying so intently that I did not hear. You said the quote from one of the first books you read about something about unexpected. It was a very powerful quote, but I did not write it down and I forgot it. So I was wondering.
That's from my friend's grandmother. Oh, wow. I have permission. She, you know, she feels embarrassed that I keep talking about her, you know, in the Sangha. But she's such a wonderful example of, you know, these qualities. And so what she said to me is that you have to leave room in your life for the unexpected to happen.
Okay. That was my first question. I have to write that down. I don't forget it. And then when you say the three characteristics, I'm sure I have them written down and I could look at, like, what are we referring to? The three characteristics, that there is suffering, that suffering is the secondary suffering, and that's the normal noble truth. So what were you referring to when you said the three characteristics?
Yeah, that's a good question. So it's the three characteristics are dukkha, anicca, anatta. So it's suffering or unsatisfactoriness. And anicca is impermanence, and anatta is not self. So one way we can say that, a little more modern translation we use sometimes, is that it's not personal, it's not perfect, it's not permanent. We can look at any aspect of life and see that this is true. Yeah, it's characterized. Any moment is characterized by those three. Yeah. Thank you. Nice to see you. Okay. You know, we're just about at time. Just check in if there's one last person who hasn't gotten their voice in, and apologize that the talk went over a little longer. I would have liked to have more time for questions, but anybody else, a burning question or comment before we move towards closing today? Okay. So I want to really thank you very deeply for your practice. Really thank you. Even times that you feel doubt about practice, if that still comes up for you, just to know that it really makes a difference. It really makes a difference in our world. And it's an honor to be together in this way. So thank you for having me, and thank you to Sangha Live. And I also want to offer around Sangha and Dharma and teachings Then I also teach a Wednesday Sangha. That's at 7:30 in the morning Pacific time. So it's 4:30 Central European time. And it's donation-based, and you're all welcome to come. And the next session is April 9th, this Wednesday. And then on Fridays, I'm going to start a metta, a loving kindness, and also chanting session. You can just listen to the chanting if you don't like that, or you can participate in it. And we'll be doing loving kindness practice on Fridays. So that also starts on April 11th. And other things, I teach retreats and teach one at the end of April that also is in person and has an online component if it works for your time zone, with Devin Haza, who's a wonderful teacher in our tradition, and lots of other things like that. So I think Sangha Live probably puts in the chat my website. You can also email me. It's just celeste@insightla.org. And I consider you part of my Sangha now because we had the chance to be together. So our sanghas weave together, and you're always welcome, and hope to be back here another time.